We are in Mark chapter 15. Mark chapter 15. We ended the last class in the Psalms. What psalm in particular did we end in? Psalm 22. Why? Why did we end in Psalm 22? Because Mark's whole crucifixion account, which is very similar to Matthew's, is the living out of, in a sense, or maybe a commentary would be a better way of even saying it, a visual commentary on Psalm 22. The only words that Jesus even speaks from the cross in the Gospel of Mark is Psalm 22, verse 1. Then you have the images of the people surrounding him, shaking their heads and hurling insults, casting the lots, dividing his clothes. Consistently, you see images of Psalm 22 emerging in the crucifixion scene of Mark's gospel. And my argument last class, what I feel like the reason why Mark's doing that is not to show that God has abandoned Jesus. I'll be honest with you, I've challenged my class before whenever I've taught this, and I myself have just racked my brain trying to think of anywhere in the New Testament where it specifically says, yes, God abandoned Jesus on the cross. This is the passage we go to. But outside of this passage, I don't know of any other passage that remotely relates to that. And if you find one, by all means, let me know, and then I'll have to figure out whether or not that overthrows what we've done or what we've talked about, or if there's a new caveat that's added. You hear, I'm not against the data, I just can't find any that's going against this. In understanding the way in which Old Testament texts are used throughout the rest of the New Testament, this is a real strong hermeneutical principle. Whenever you see an Old Testament text quoted in Romans or in Galatians or really anywhere, do not just stop at the one verse. The whole point is to get you to have the context in mind that's around it. And once you put it in that context, a lot of times you understand the full picture they're trying to paint with the one verse. Same thing here. Why is Jesus singing Psalm 21:1 on the cross? Because he knows how the psalm ends. For he has done it. Done what? Brought about the redemption, established the kingdom, started, inaugurated a new creation. Sam, you had a question?
I was just wondering, when Paul writes that he became sin, that was one of the arguments that I've always heard. That
Yeah, and the whole concept, let me just kind of put this in place. Because this is theology that we get. We're trying to understand God, and the ways in which we describe him sometimes are kind of silly. God's not allergic to sin. It's not like when it comes near him, he's like, I got to get away. Like, oh no, you know, the sin's coming and it'll infect me. I mean, my word, if we see Job, Satan walks into the presence of God in the Old Testament. If God was allergic to sin, he'd have nothing to do with us ever. Just because even if Jesus does become sin, it doesn't mean that God can't be around him because he just can't. What does that say about, if that's the way God is, what does that say about his relationship between me and him? See, whenever we get some kind of weird theologies that make God into this kind of like, having these new attributes or characteristics, sometimes it actually affects the way I interact with him. Because if he's allergic to sin, and that's pretty much all that I am, well, then what does that say? He's not allergic to sin. He's a big boy. Satan doesn't scare him. Okay, it's not like he's getting away from the sin cooties, and when Jesus becomes sin, he's like, I got to get out of here. I just can't take it. That's not him. He's bigger than that. So my response back would be, where in the Bible does it say that God's allergic to sin? I don't understand. He hates it. He's going to deal with it. But it's not like he can't be around it. Does that make sense? So, does God, in Jesus' darkest moment, abandon him? Psalm 22 would say, absolutely not. It may look like it, and my goodness, you will go through times in your life when it feels like God's abandoned you. But I'm telling you, it doesn't matter how dark it gets, even if you feel like you're hanging on your own cross, he's not abandoned you. He doesn't. It's just not him. That's not in his nature. That is something he's allergic to, abandoning his creation. Which is one of the reasons why we've been waiting 2,000 years for him to come back and end this thing, and he just won't. He just won't. He's pursuing us, and he won't let us go. Jesus dies on the cross in Mark chapter 15, verse 33 through 34. Well, he doesn't die yet, I guess, technically. We're almost there. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? When some of those standing near heard this, they said, listen, he's calling Elijah. Why? Why would they think he's calling Elijah? Historically, put it together. Not theologically, historically. Maybe linguistically. Why would they think he's calling Elijah? Yeah. Yeah, whenever he's hanging on a cross, and he's already parched, his tongue probably is sticking to the roof of his mouth, like Psalm 22 says. He's probably not going to be worried about enunciating in that moment. And Eloi and Eli, Eli or Eloi, it depends on how you're pronouncing the Elijah's name in the Aramaic. They would probably sound phonetically similar, especially in the condition that Jesus is in. So it's not like that historically that they're just being dumb here. They probably don't know exactly everything he is saying, and yet they do recognize that he probably is calling for God to move in some way, shape, or form. Now, theologically, why would Elijah be important?
People believe that Elijah would come down in take care of the situation, or even save them, possibly.
Elijah is an eschatological figure. He's real important. Malachi 4:5 specifically mentions Elijah's name as coming before the great and the dreadful day of the Lord. He is God's agent of eschatology, inauguration of a kingdom. Maybe they thought what he was doing is trying to call the name Elijah to rescue him in a sense to inaugurate the kingdom. Basically, they're saying, oh, he's looking for a last-ditch effort, anything at this point, just to be saved, just to be rectified. But why is that a foolish question or a foolish thought? Historically, I get it. Theologically, I can understand it. But why is it foolish in the narrative of the Gospel of Mark for them to be thinking that's what Jesus is doing? Say it again. Some thought he was Elijah. Maybe, yeah. What else? In the Gospel of Mark narrative, why would we say, no, he's not calling for Elijah? Why would we say that based on what Jesus has said and done so far? Because Jesus has consistently been preaching that Elijah has already come. He's not looking for Elijah to come in the future. Elijah has already come. Really, we could point to at least two places where Elijah's come. Number one, Mark 1. Mark 1 with John the Baptist preparing the way for the Lord coming, making straight the paths, the voice calling out in the desert. And then comes on the scene John the Baptist dressed kind of like Elijah. And if that doesn't convince people, well, then we at least have the transfiguration in Mark 9 when Elijah's there. And yet, whenever they're walking down, the disciples ask a very similar question. I thought Elijah had to come first. And what did Jesus say? If you understood who John was, you'd realize Elijah did come. He already did come. He was the harbinger of my ministry, of the kingdom. You just called him John. So the fact that they are saying, maybe he's calling Elijah, clues us in once again, they just don't know who Jesus is. They just don't get his ministry. They don't get what he's doing. They're on the outside looking in. One man ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar and put it on a stick and offered it to Jesus to drink. Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down, he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. This is the second miraculous sign that's pointing to the identity of Jesus in Mark's gospel. In Matthew, we have other ones, like people breaking out of graves and things of that nature, but you have to take Matthew to talk about that. In Mark's gospel, there's the second miraculous sign. What was the first? Say it again.
Darkness.
And why was that significant? Why is that such a significant sign? Political change, political upheaval, a new creation. What is happening in that moment is so significant that literally, it is nothing in the cosmos will ever be the same again. and the darkness and coming into new light is representative of a new creation as well as political upheaval. This new sign has similar implications. What it could possibly mean is a couple of things, and probably all of them are right. Number one, it could mean that this is a pronouncement of judgment on the temple, on the nation of Israel as itself. Why? Well, it really kind of depends on which veil was being torn. There's two options. Both of them are good ones. We don't know exactly. If I had to be pushed into one, I'd probably take the second one, but the first one's just as legitimate. What veil is being torn? It could be the veil between the court of the Jews and the court of the Gentiles. There was one. And obviously the implications of that would be that because Jesus' kingdom has come, he is judging the prejudices that have caused the Jews to take God's house of prayer for the nations and turn it into a citadel from which they launch an attack on the nations, on the Gentiles. Or number two, it could be the veil between the Holy of Holies and the rest of the temple, which would mean that everyone has access to God at this point, not just the high priest. That God's presence is not locked up into one place any longer, but it will be spreading. It could be a precursor for the Holy Spirit, things of that nature. I do find it quite significant that if it was the Holy of Holies, a section out of Josephus would be really important. Josephus is describing Pompey, the Roman general in the first century BC, coming into Judea on his way of kind of regathering the chaos before the first triumvirate. We don't have time to go into that. Take New Testament intro. next year. We can't do it next semester. Anyway, Pompey goes in, and he has this veiled reference where Pompey actually goes into the Holy of Holies in the temple in Jerusalem. And what's strange is in Josephus' account, he suggests that Pompey finds nothing. Why would that be shocking? What is he supposed to be finding? What is he supposed to have found when he goes into the Holy of Holies? What's supposed to be residing there? Ark of the Covenant, which represents what? God's presence with his people. It is suggested then that the Ark of the Covenant never made it back from exile. And that God's presence with his people, with the rebellious people in the intertestamental period, was not as acute as what they had thought it was or what they had perpetuated. Because year after year, the high priest would be going into the Holy of Holies, doing the things on the Day of Atonement he is supposed to be doing, knowing every year that the Ark of the Covenant was not there. And when the veil is torn, that whole sham has been revealed to everyone that can see into the Holy of Holies. For God's presence is not there. Where is God's presence? Well, it's hanging on a tree right now. That's where it is. Second miraculous sign has major implications because I think in essence it's a judgment once again on the nation of Israel and the cultic system that was oppressive towards those that God was trying to bring in through the temple. Verse 39. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Four things I want you guys to know or to notice about this. Well, technically five. Number one, at this point, you've got to remember everyone's abandoned Jesus. Everyone. We literally have no one that's surrounding Jesus right now in the narrative that is on Jesus' side. For his disciples are gone. For the crowds have turned against him. For the Jewish elite, well, they were hardly ever on his side anyway. And you even have the insurrectionists, the political revolutionaries that are hanging on the crosses next to Jesus, and they're hurling insults in Mark's gospel as well. He is completely abandoned. And the one person that stands up for him is a Roman centurion. If that's not an irony of all ironies, I don't know what is. A couple of things, though. Number one, the Greek emphasizes the word "this," that's why I read it the way I read it. There is a distinct emphasis in the Greek syntax that says, "this man," surely this man. is the Son of God. And the implications of the syntax is this man as opposed to that man. This man is the Son of God. Now that Greek syntax is significant because of the phrase Son of God. We've already talked about this. Think back to the first 2 weeks of school. Why is the Son of God language so important, so significant? Because the emperor was known as the Son of God. As a matter of fact, Julius Caesar, one of the key reasons why he was killed was because he was allowing people, in a sense, to revere him and to exalt him up to the level of the gods while he was living. Julius Caesar, that was a major political mistake because it ticked off the Senate so bad that finally Brutus and a couple of their friends take him to the theater of Pompey, which there's some significance in that Roman history, and they kill him. Well, whenever his adopted son, Octavian, who becomes Augustus, comes to power, they at one point want to make him God. But what does Octavian do? Oh, I'm so meek. No, don't call me a god. Now you can call me the son of a god, but don't call me God, because I'm not a god. I'm merely a man. But, you know, my dad was a god. So you can call me son of God, but just don't call me God. And what appears to be a moment of meagerness or meekness is actually Augustus exalting himself without anybody really realizing he's exalting himself. It's a brilliant political tactic. But from then on, the imperial cult begins to develop in a wider range, the worship of the emperor as a god, particularly after his death. But the reigning emperor at the time, before he became a god once he died, he was known as the Son of God. It was on his coins. It was on his architecture. It was on all of the imperial propaganda. And you have this Roman centurion, and that's the third point that makes this quite ironic. First point is the Greek syntax emphasizes this. Second one is that the Son of God language is reserved for emperors. The third one is the fact that this is a centurion that is saying this. Piece all that together and you have a centurion saying, this man is the emperor, as opposed to that one. The centurion is saying something that you would expect out of the mouths of the disciples of Jesus. But it is not something that you would expect out of the disciples of the emperor. You just wouldn't expect, though, the followers of the emperor to be saying, no, this man is the king, as opposed to that one. And I find it significant because of the fourth point of why this is an important phrase to be reflecting on. This bookends the entire book of Mark. How does Mark 1:1 begin? Remember, can you quote it without even me reading it? The beginning of the gospel, the euangelion, about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The entire gospel of Mark begins with this politically explosive verse, which states, which sets the foundation, which sets the terrain of kingdom political language that's inaugurating the establishment of a kingdom of which Jesus is the king. And now we come to the end of the book of Mark and he's saying the same thing. He's saying, don't forget, he came to establish a kingdom. But the fact that it is here that it comes up is Mark pointing towards how this kingdom is being established. Through suffering on a cross. You see, that's the weird political aspect of this that we didn't get in Mark 1:1. In Mark 1:1, it's so politically explosive, I'm going, my word, that'll get you crucified by itself. Just the first verse. But Mark 1:1 doesn't tell you the full story. You get the full story whenever you pair Mark 1:1 with Mark 15:39. For how is this Son of God establishing His kingdom? For the centurion, what convinced him was the cross. That's how our kingdom advances. That's how we win. And this is all over the Bible. This is not just in the Gospels. It's everywhere. Revelation chapter 12, verse 11. It's talking about the big dragon, which at this time of year is very appropriate. The dragon that's coming, trying to devour the child that the woman is giving birth to, the child that will rule all the nations with an iron scepter, verse 5. Whenever he can't devour the child, he then goes to heaven in verse 9 and starts fighting this war against Michael and the archangels. And basically, the dragon and his angels are thrown down, cast to the earth. And then all of heaven begins to sing in verse 10. The They say, "For great, Lord, great are you. Great are the rejoice, O heavens. Woe to you, earth." Because the dragon's down there and he's raging. But the accuser can no longer come before God anymore. "For we have overcome the dragon," verse 11. How, it says? "Through the blood of the Lamb." Through the blood of the Lamb. Through suffering. And, it says, "through the testimony of the saints that do not love their lives so much that they would shrink from death." It's pretty consistent. How do we win? How does the Son of God establish His kingdom in 1:1? You got to go to 15:39 to be able to answer that question. He establishes kingdom through suffering on a cross. And Revelation 12:11 says, "So how should you advance His kingdom?" And then the ethical charge is something we've already reflected on some already. I do find it significant, though, as well, based on Psalm 22, the way in which this whole scene is developed. Psalm 22 ends by stating that those that will worship the Lord will be the rich of the earth. The rich ones of the earth is the way in which the Psalm 22 ends. What we have here is one of the people that is one of the power brokers of the world, a Roman centurion, worshiping the king. Oh, that'll preach so easily, honestly. I mean, if you want a sermon, just give the historical background of this passage and you'll have people probably flocking for an altar call, because Mark just literally beautifully weaves all these pieces together and is offering an incredible challenge that we'll talk about more in detail tomorrow. Verse 40. "Some women were watching from a distance." Oh! There's some good bad here in this verse. The good is, hey, Jesus isn't completely abandoned. I mean, the Roman centurion comes on the scene and kind of redeems the situation, but Jesus does have some followers still around. We didn't know that until after the centurion, but He does have some. Awesome! Not exactly. There's two things that make this actually a pretty shaming verse and not a good one. Number one, it's women. Those are the ones that don't abandon Him. We've already talked about the way in which women were treated and viewed in the ancient world. And this detail would not have been something that brought people excitement, but shame. Because whenever your political revolution at its end, that everyone has abandoned you except for the women, it wouldn't scream that you have a very wildly successful political revolution. For the only thing following you at the end is the parasites of society? Awesome. Put that on your resume. I'm sure your kingdom will go far. There's another problem. It's not just that it's women. It's that they're even standing off at a distance. In Mark's gospel, unlike John's gospel, the women don't even want to be closely associated with Jesus. They're there, but they're at a distance, and he emphasizes that very clearly. They are not close. Why? Because getting close to someone that's hanging on a tree for political insurrection is probably not the best of ideas. And in Mark's gospel, it emphasizes that while they weren't completely abandoned, he may as well have been considered completely abandoned, because only women were still around. And they were even at a distance. So there's kind of a bittersweet thing in verse 40. "Among them, though, were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the younger, and of Joseph, and Salome." Three different women that are at a distance following Jesus. And in Mark's gospel, we really don't know much about any of these women. Mary Magdalene, for example, this is the first time she is mentioned in the Gospel of Mark, although she will be a prominent figure over the next 5 to 15 verses. I say 15 because it does stretch into the extra verses at the end of Mark, and we'll talk about why her appearance in verse 9 actually plays against the authenticity of 16, 9 through 20. But Mary Magdalene, first time she's mentioned in Mark. We do know from Luke chapter 8, verse 2, that Mary Magdalene was healed of evil spirits. She was demon-possessed and a disease. 7 demons come out of her. That's pretty much all we know about Mary Magdalene throughout history. That's all we really know. All the stuff about her being a prostitute, there's just no evidence for that historically. We just don't have evidence for that. A lot of people will try to suggest that Mary Magdalene is the woman in John 7:53 through 8:11, the prostitute that's caught in adultery, that's bowing at the feet of Jesus. Problem is, that whole text in and of itself is questionable as well. And her name's never mentioned anyway. All the stuff about Dan Brown, all the junk that he's put out, honestly, in historical settings, it's laughable. There's just no evidence. He's fabricated. I don't care what the beginning of his book says. Fact. Da da da. 99.9% of that book is fabricated. We just don't know anything about Mary Magdalene. And that's the reason why she makes for good fiction. Because since you don't know a lot about her, and yet she seems to be an important figure in some way, shape, or form, you want to create a narrative around her. But we just don't have evidence to do that historically. So if you're okay with doing it without historical integrity, by all means, create whatever you want. But I'm not concerned about fun theories. I'm concerned about what history delivers to us. It's what Helen Bond, when she was Skyping with my New Testament intro class, said. Somebody asked her about, should we talk about the historical Jesus from the pulpit? She said, well, your people in the pews are either going to be getting it from you or Dan Brown. Which would you choose? I said, good point. We should talk about the historical Jesus at least some. But that's Mary Magdalene. You also have Mary, the mother of James the Younger and Joseph. Again, this is the first time this woman is mentioned in Mark's Gospel. We don't know a ton about her. What we can assume, though, is that the emphasis on James the Younger is trying to point out someone that's connected to this woman that at least Mark's audience should be able to recognize. It is conjectured, and probably accurately conjectured, that the James that is being talked about there is the James that is referenced as the son of Alphaeus in Matthew chapter 10, verse 3, one of the disciples of Jesus. Remember, we have more than one James, disciple of Jesus. James, the son of Alphaeus, Matthew chapter 10, verse 3. But we also have another James, and who is that? The son of Zebedee. And we'll get to him in just a moment. Or right now. Because the third woman, Salome, we don't know who she is either. This isn't any reference to the illegitimate daughter, I don't know how to even say that accurately, of Herod. This is talking about the mother. Matter of fact, in Matthew's Gospel, Matthew 27:56, this third woman is identified as the mother of the sons of Zebedee. So more than likely, this is her name, Salome, the mother of the sons of Zebedee. Now, this woman's pretty significant for me, being here in this moment. Because in Matthew's Gospel, Matthew chapter 20, 20 through 28, the parallel of Mark chapter 10, in Matthew's Gospel, the mother of the sons of Zebedee is the one that goes to Jesus and asks Jesus to give her sons the chief seats, to sit at his right and to sit at his left when he comes into his glory. Now, in Mark's Gospel, it's the sons of Zebedee. In Matthew's, it's the mother of the sons of Zebedee. Now, this is significant because if you're the mother of the sons of Zebedee and you're standing at a distance and you're watching Jesus being crucified, and as he is being crucified, all of a sudden you see someone sitting at his right and his left. In that moment, as a mother, your stomach had to sink. You had to sit there and think, if he would have granted my request, my boys would be hanging next to him right now. I didn't know what I was asking. I think in this moment, possibly Salome is overcome with so much grief. That's why in a minute, we're only going to have two of the women that are going to be still be tracking Joseph of Arimathea. And the third one, Salome, is not to be found. My assumption historically is that she's probably so overwhelmed with what could have possibly happened to her sons that emotionally she just wasn't able to continue going. The significance, though, of Mark merely mentioning their names without giving any of the background here, says what? What? The church knew who these women were. Same thing with Rufus Alexander and Rufus earlier at the beginning whenever Simon was carrying the cross. Same concept. You just mentioned their names. They don't need an introduction. Why? Everyone knows them. Who Mark is writing to, everyone knows them. Verse 41, in Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. Many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there. So there's more. Verse 42, it was preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath. So as evening approached, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent member of the council, who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, went boldly to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. Whoa, lot here. Jesus is crucified on Friday. The day of preparation would be referring to the time period leading up to the Sabbath. Knowing that the day begins at 6 p.m., day ends and begins at 6 p.m. Matter of fact, a Jew would say that the Sabbath begins at 6 p.m. on Friday. And it carries over through the 24-hour period where the Sabbath will end on 6 p.m. on Saturday. This is where we're at right now. The women will get the herbs and things and the spices to prepare Jesus' burial sometime in this evening before the next morning when they visit the tomb. So that's the time period we're at. The preparation day, getting things ready to go before the Sabbath 24-hour period sets in place at 6 o'clock on Friday night. So as evening approached, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent member of the council, what does that mean? What council? More than likely, this is pointing to the fact that Joseph of Arimathea was a prominent member of the Sanhedrin. Whoa. Why is that significant? What's that? Yeah, they're the reason he was crucified. It's the Jewish elite. This is not just some random guy that just comes on the scene and he's like Simon the Cyrene saying, hey, I'll bury him. This is one of the Jewish elite, the Sanhedrin, the leading council members of the region that's coming boldly to Pilate and saying, I want to bury him. There's a couple of reasons why that's very significant, especially in an honor-shame society. Number one, burial in a shameful way has ramifications not only on you as a person, but on the entire group that you're involved with. It's one of the reasons why I do believe that the early church, the way it was able to meet and function legally within the Roman constraints and the Roman law, was that the early church probably were burial associations, where they were groups that would get together in order to pool their money together and buy plots of land for the poor, so that the poor, when they become a part of the burial association, they then could actually be buried in an honorable way. And that's why when you go to Rome today, you go through the Christian catacombs, where there's just tunnels underneath the city, and it's full of people that are buried, and yet there's Christian graffiti everywhere. Because more than likely, the Christians are the ones that have pulled their money together to buy these underground catacombs to give honorable burial to the poor, which would pull in all kinds of really cool imagery, ways of sharing the gospel. Being buried in a shameful way means you're probably poor monetarily as well as honor. It's a shameful thing. And to go and try to bring honor to the one that the Jewish elite have condemned as a blasphemer, that can hardly be overstated how significant that is. You just don't do that. They got what they wanted. This is the man that has stolen all the honor from the Jews all throughout his life. And now whenever we finally get the shame put on him, when he dies the death that Deuteronomy 21 says is cursed by God, when he dies a death that belongs to only failed revolutionaries, you want to bring him honor by burying him honorably? Not only was it bold because of what it would do between him and the rest of the Jewish elite, but it was also bold before Rome. Because Joseph of Arimathea, unlike the disciples, unlike even in some sense the women here in Mark's gospel, unlike pretty much everyone, Joseph of Arimathea was okay with people recognizing him as someone that was a follower of Jesus. He had no problems with it. Because he boldly goes before Pilate and says, let me give the man that you condemned as a political revolutionary an honorable burial, please. Joseph of Arimathea also, this is pretty significant to me as well. In Matthew 27:57, it describes Joseph of Arimathea as a rich man. And the only other time that appears in Matthew's gospel, that language, as well as Mark's gospel, is in the passage in Matthew 19:25-26. When the disciples heard this, how difficult it was for the rich man to enter into heaven, they were greatly astonished and asked, well, then who can be saved? And Jesus looked at them and said, with man this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible. This rich man who denies everything, even risking monetarily, as well as his honor in order to bring Jesus honor, Jesus says, that's the kind of man that can be saved. But that's not easy. Because he knows he's given up everything in order to pledge allegiance to me. So this prominent member of the council, who himself was waiting for the kingdom of God, longing for the kingdom of God to come. I don't believe at this moment Joseph Arimathea thought, hey, the kingdom's been established through the cross. That's not, I don't think he thought that. But I think that he thought Jesus deserved an honorable burial, even though the kingdom hadn't been established like he thought it was going to be. He went boldly to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. Pilate was surprised to hear that he was already dead. Most of the time, crucifixions take a lot longer than this. Was it just because he was weak? I don't think you can make those implications. We'll keep going. Summoning the centurion, he asked him if Jesus had already died. Why is that significant? It could have been the same centurion that just pronounced that this was the king of the world. That's pretty ironic if it is. Another reason why it's significant. Yeah. Go ahead. Keep going. Yeah, more than likely, Pilate's going, he's already dead. Is there something happening here that you're trying to, like, maybe a swoon theory starting to develop? Is that what's happening? No, I'm going to go and ask the guy that won't make a mistake about whether or not a person is dead that was supposed to be executed. Centurions don't make mistakes. They are trained killing machines. That's what they do. They are absolutely, they are machines of psychological torture as well as physical torture. And they are not going to allow, especially knowing the ramifications, that they could experience some of the, some of the punishment of the prisoner themselves if it wasn't carried through the way it was supposed to be, the way it was mandated. The centurion's not going to make a mistake. He will know if the person is dead or not, and if he's not, he will make sure he's dead. So Pilate goes, okay, Joseph Arimathea, I'm not sure what your angle is here, but I'm going to call in a valid witness to really see if this guy is dead or not. Calls in the centurion, and this summoning the centurion to see if Jesus was already dead. Verse 45, when he learned from the centurion that it was so, that he was in fact dead, he gave the body to Joseph. So Joseph bought some linen cloth, took down the body, wrapped it in the linen, and placed it in a tomb cut out of rock. And he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. In Matthew's gospel, it says that this wasn't just some just random tomb. This was actually Joseph of Arimathea's tomb that had not even been used yet. It was his own. He was saying, I am binding myself with this person, even though he was shamefully killed. A tomb was not a cheap thing. Don't think of a plot of land 6 feet deep. Think of a carving into the side of a mountain, a cave. And it wasn't easy just to go in and make one of those. They weren't just robust. Not everybody got a nice tomb. If you had a tomb, it was because you were rich or because you were honorable. And Joseph Arimathea says, I'm going to take my tomb and I'm going to honorably wrap him and bury him in a way in which those that are honored get buried. And once he is in there, then we are going to roll the stone over. The stone in front of the tomb, you'd have this deep groove that then you would take this large rock and you would set it in and it would actually lodge into the ground. And that was done for two reasons. Number one, for honorable reasons. You didn't want an animal to have access to the body of the person that you were trying to honor through an honorable burial. And whenever the rock would go down in front of it, it would seal the tomb so that nothing could get in or out. Number two, not just logical or honorable reasons, but practical reasons. The body, even though you try to drown it out with all kinds of herbs and spices, would stink. And the stone in front of the tomb would seal it in place so that the stench would not be able to get out as well. It was sealed. Matter of fact, we don't get this in Mark's gospel. We'll end with this today because there's an interesting theological application to this. In Matthew's gospel, at this point, the Jewish elite in chapter 27, they go and they ask for some Roman guards to be put in front because they didn't want the disciples stealing the body and deceiving people that he had raised from the dead. See, the Jews knew some of the rumors that had been going around. So Pilate says, fine, you can take some Roman guards, go stand guard. Matter of fact, it says in verse 66 that they actually took a seal and sealed the tomb. And what that would have been a wax seal, a large wax seal that would have had the insignia of Rome on it. And then a cord would have been tied from one side to the other, stating that if anybody breaks this seal, they are breaking the authority of Rome. And it's the exact same word for seal that's used in Revelation chapter 20, verse 3, when Satan is put into prison and it is sealed shut. And what I find theologically ironic and beautiful all at the same time is that both in Revelation chapter 20, verse 3, as well as in Mark chapter 15, as well as in Matthew chapter 27, as well as all the resurrection accounts, the seal is broken by God in both accounts. But the irony is that where the seal is broken in Revelation 23 and Satan is led to his destruction, in Mark chapter 15, God will break the seal and Jesus will be headed to victory. And we'll talk about that tomorrow. Love you guys. See you then.